From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. What you've just heard is an example of Renaissance Italian court music, the topic of a forthcoming book of cultural history by one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. He is William Prizer, a professor of music at the University of California at Santa Barbara. What was the social function of music in Italian court life during the 15th and 16th centuries? How do patronage and music in the Italian Renaissance reflect cultural circumstances and contexts? Bill Prizer, you are a music historian. You are writing about music in Italy in the 15th and 16th centuries. Before we go to your topic at the Humanities Center, tell me about music and society in the most general terms. Are there assumptions and premises that music historians talk about amongst themselves about the enterprise that they're involved in?
I think the basic assumption, Wayne, is that music does have a function mm-hmm. in society, that it does not exist in vacuo mm-hmm. as a major artwork or a minor artwork right. or a bad piece of music, uh-huh. but rather that music is written for a purpose, that it has something to tell us about the way society views itself, mm-hmm. so that a Mozart symphony is not only a masterpiece, but it's also a work that Mozart wrote for a given performance mm-hmm. to fulfill certain needs.
Well, Bill Prizer, let's go to your topic. You are a scholar at the Humanities Center. You're working on Italian music at court. Do I have that right? In the 15th and 16th centuries
That's
in Italy?
Right. That's right.
What were the social circumstances like during this period in this fairly restricted court setting that you are looking at in Italy in the 15th and 16th centuries?
Well, the first thing to be said is to emphasize the overwhelming importance of the patrons themselves. Uh-huh. At court, the patrons' whims are law. And if a court musician was paid better than any other kind of musician in his day, that is better than a musician in a cathedral or better than a town musician, let mm-hmm. us say, he also had many more risks to run because he could incur the wrath of his patron very easily. The kinds of training that a musician would go through before he would be taken on at a court would be generally one of two things. Either he might go through a cathedral school, learn singing, composition, and so forth, mm-hmm. or he might be, if he were an instrumentalist, be brought up through an apprentice system mm-hmm. so that his father would have taught him his art mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. And one has examples of both of those mm-hmm. at court at this time. Wayne, this first example is a piece by Bartolomeo Tromboncino, one of the major composers of the genre that I work on mostly, known as mm-hmm. the Frottola, mm-hmm. which is a little Italian lute song.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this a name that would be known among music historians today? It's certainly not a household name.
It's not a household name at all. Uh-huh. It certainly is a name that's known by music historians, without uh-huh. a doubt,
fair enough.
As is the genre of music, the Frottola, mm-hmm. that Tromboncino wrote in.
And the Frottola, what does that mean?
Well,
does it have a translation?
It does. In modern Italian, it means a fib. A small lie. Huh. In the 14th century, it meant something rustic and not worthy of courtly attention.
So we had a little class distinction.
There is a class
going on
there.
Here. All right.
But in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, it simply is the name of the kind of music that uh-huh. the North Italian courts are patronizing.
All right, and what is the name of this? Does it have a specific name that we're
well,
about to listen to?
Well, it has an incipit, that is, the first line is what it's known as. Uh-huh. This is Ben che il ciel m'abbia tolto, that is, though heavens took you from me.
All right.
And it is a typical piece about unrequited love in which the singer says that he will never love another even though the heavens have taken his one love away from him.
All right.
And that she is the only person who can revive a man entombed and so forth. This short composition is performed by Anthony Rooley on lute and the Consort of Music, a London-based group.
All right, let's listen. Bill Prizer, this Frottola that we have just listened to from the court at Mantua in early Renaissance Italy is about unrequited love. That sort of summarizes the theme. Are there other circumstances that we might be aware of about the composition of this piece, the audience to whom it was directed?
Well, it very clearly was directed towards a court audience who would be familiar with the conceits of courtly love.
Does that mean one person in the court would have inspired this, or is it may or may not have been?
No, I think it's more generalized
I
than
see.
That.
Uh-huh.
It's simply entertainment music for the court in a day without television and without soundings, radio show.
When would this have been performed, for instance? Over a banquet, or what would the circumstances have been?
It certainly could have been done during a banquet, although, as far as I can tell, it's more normal to retire after the banquet with simply a few people and to sit around and either listen to the professional musicians perform these, or indeed for the court members themselves to perform them.
Bill, do you find in this Frottola a particular resonance of the relationship between the musician and the patron, or is this representative somehow?
Indeed. In this particular instance, it is very representative in that these composers, Tromboncino, whom we've just heard, and Marchetto Cara, another whom we'll hear shortly, were writing for a specific patron. That is, they were writing for Isabella d'Este, one of the great patrons of art as well as music of her day. And she herself was a performer. She was a lutenist and a singer, and many of their pieces were written not so much for them to perform, that is, them being the musicians themselves, but for her to perform.
Bill Prizer, the woman that you have just mentioned, Isabella d'Este, is she royalty? Is she wealthy? How would she have come to inspire this music?
Well, she is the wife of the ruler of the Marquisate of Mantua. Her husband is Francesco Gonzaga, who is the Marquis of Mantua. Therefore, she is herself a ruler of the area.
Is this what we have just heard, does that reflect a particular favorite kind of music on the part of the patron?
I think so, without a doubt. And we can trace, in fact, changes in musical style using as one of our bases changes in tastes of the patrons.
Bill, give me another example of court music at Mantua.
Well, another one rather similar to that one, but in a more humorous vein, making fun of the conceits of courtly love, is Bona Dies, Bona Sera by Tromboncino's colleague in Mantua, Marchetto Cara.
Translate that title for me.
It means good day, good evening.
Now, when you say the conceits of courtly love, be concrete for me.
Well, the conceits of courtly love, that is, the beliefs that are contained in it, whether they were held seriously or not, were that the woman was to remain on a pedestal, and that the man would worship her from afar, never achieving his desired outcome.
Now, this would derive principally from the poetry of people like Dante and Petrarch.
Even earlier.
Earlier than that.
In in southern France, the troubadours, and in northern France, the trouvères were already in the 12th and 13th centuries dealing with this kind of...
So we have these notions of women on pedestals, and then by way of counterpoint to that, what we're about to listen to is a piece of music that, gives the lie to these conceits, as you call them?
The verse of this piece reads as follows. Therefore, lady, while you can, make certain time does not pass you by, and count well your days, for he who does not fish catches nothing.
This reminds me of, I believe the term for it is carpe diem, seize the day. Andrew Marvell, let's live and make merry, tomorrow we die, all of that.
Well, one of the most famous examples of that kind of carpe diem attitude comes, in fact, from exactly this time, and that is Lorenzo de Medici's poem, Quante bella la giovinezza, how beautiful is youth, for it is so fleeting, and so forth.
Well, let's listen to another example here of court music at the court of Mantua in the 15th century in Italy. Tell me exactly what we're going to listen to and who wrote it.
This is Buona Dies, Buona Sera by Marchetto Cara, and it's performed by another London-based group circa 1500.
Buona dies, buona sera, io credea fosse buono. Passi il giorno, passa l'ora, e però vien presto sera. Buona dies, buona sera, io credea fosse buono. Per Madonna, finché poi fa che il tempo non ti incresca, e mi insorra i giorni tuoi, che mai piglia chi non pesca, presto il fuoco accende e l'esca, fallo dunque volontiera. Buona dies, buona sera, io credea fosse buon'ora, passi il giorno, passa l'ora, e però vien presto sera.
Bill Prizer, we are listening to court music composed at the court of Mantua in the 15th century, Italian music. We've just listened to a piece which translates as Good Morning, Good Evening by a composer named Marchetto Cara. Tell me about the musical quality of what we have just heard. Are there peculiarities here that would be absolutely foreign to a modern audience?
Well, I don't think so, although modern audiences are not all that accustomed to listening to music before, at best, Monteverdi, let's say, early 17th century. And when they do, they tend to listen to the great masterworks of that early period, the masses and motets written for church services. This, on the other hand, is a much more delicate piece. It is a simple lute song done for court entertainment, and does not replace the masses and motets that people may be more familiar with, but is an important element of musical life all the same. As important an element of musical life as the masses and motets were as a part of church life.
Bill, how do you figure out how this stuff was performed? How do you know that what you as a music historian at the University of California in the 1980s, how do you know that what you're listening to replicates what these Italian court audiences in the 15th century listened to?
Well, in a certain sense, we don't. We are trying as hard as we can to reconstruct the circumstances.
I take it that you have in front of you what you would call a text, that is to say, the musical composition.
We do have a text, but early texts, to continue with your use of the term, do not tell us nearly as much as a Mozart text would tell us.
What would be a difference, for instance?
Well, they don't even tell us what instruments were to be used, you see. They simply say, in general, here are four parts to this piece. They assume that the person who is performing them knows the conventions of the day. So one of our jobs, of course, then, is to define what the conventions were.
Just very briefly, Bill Prizer, tell me, how do you reconstruct this sort of thing?
Well, my basic technique is to try to find descriptions from the time of performance of pieces that will tell us what instruments were used and so forth.
Ear witness accounts.
Exactly.
All right. Fair enough. Bill Prizer, you are a music historian at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Let's move on to some more examples of this court music composed at Mantua in the 15th century in Italy. We have heard two examples of this sort of composition. Give me yet another.
Well, it might be interesting to move to a different kind of music. Mm-hmm. We've heard two examples of the frottola, the secular lute song. Why don't we move now to devotional song, as used at the courts. This is a kind of music known as the lauda, which comes from the Italian meaning praise. And this kind of music was used for many different purposes. It was used in the church services upon occasion. It was used, in Florence, for example, by companies of artisans who would meet and join together once a week or so and sing these laude to statues of the Virgin and so forth.
So they would have a religious praising function as well as a secular one?
What they do not have is a liturgical function.
Now, explain that term for me.
What that means is that they do not have a specific place
in the Mass.
In the Mass or in the offices, such as Vespers or Matins and so forth. They're not texts that come from those services themselves.
All right, what are we about to listen to?
Wayne, what we're about to listen to is a Venetian lauda from the late 15th, early 16th century, written by a composer named Innocentius Damonis. This is a lauda entitled Amor Gesù Divino, O Divine Love of Jesus, that was intended for Christmas. And I have picked this example because it seems to me to fit in very well with one of the major functions of the lauda in Mantua itself.
And that would be what?
Well, it has to do with processions that went through the town on major feast days. In Mantua, particularly important is the procession that went through town from church to church on the Feast of the Purification of the Virgin on the 2nd of July. Francesco Gonzaga, the patron of this kind of music in Mantua, selected this day because it was the anniversary of his victory over Charles VIII of, France in 1495, and he proclaimed thereby that there would be a procession each July the 2nd.
So this, parenthetically, Bill Prizer, comes back to one of your original points, that that this music really had a social function. It carries with it repercussions of political events, social circumstances around its composition.
Exactly. And in this instance, too, this particular element of patronage is tied into artistic patronage also. Because Francesco Gonzaga, while on the battlefield, prayed to the Virgin that he be allowed to win. And if he were, he promised the Virgin a painting.
All right.
And this painting he commissioned after the battle, and it still exists today. It's a magnificent work by Andrea Mantegna entitled Madonna della Vittoria, that is, Our Lady of Victory, showing the Virgin enthroned and Francesco himself kneeling before her. Each July the 2nd, Francesco would have this painting taken down from the church he built to contain the painting and would carry it through the streets of Mantua while singing these laude.
Bill, tell me once again quickly what we're about to listen to and who wrote it.
This is Amor Gesù Divino by Innocentius Damonis, and it's performed by Konrad Ruland and the Niederaltaischer Scholaren.
Thank you.
program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about music and cultural patronage in Italian court life during the Renaissance period in Europe. My guest is William Prizer, a music historian from the University of California at Santa Barbara. William Prizer recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming book entitled Music in Mantua during the period of Isabella d'Este. All right, Bill Prizer, our topic is Italian court music in the 15th century in Italy. We've been talking about the musical qualities. We've been talking about the social circumstances surrounding these compositions. Give me yet another example.
Well, it might be interesting to return to the Frottola, but in a slightly different way.
How so?
Well, beginning in about the middle part of the first decade of the 16th century, the texts for these Frottole begin to change. And this, again, in my mind, is the result of the wishes of the patron. In this instance, Isabella d'Este, whom we've already mentioned. In 1504, Isabella got the idea that it would be a wonderful idea to not only do the simple verse that the Frottola was being written to, but also to include really high verse to it. And so she wrote to a friend of hers, a poet at another court, and asked him to pick a poem by Petrarch that he thought would be a good one to
And that certainly would have been a household name in those days.
Oh, Petrarch was very, very famous at the time. All of the nobility carried their pocket copies of Petrarch with them so that they could whip it out and read poetry to their lady at a moment's notice. So Isabella wrote, and the poet, whose name was Niccolò da Correggio, wrote back and said, I think a good one for your purposes would be Si è debile il filo, and yes, the thread is weak that attaches me to you, my lady. And Isabella had her musician, Tromboncino, whom we've already heard, set this piece. Now, from this point on, we begin to get first a trickle and then really a wide stream of these pieces of Petrarch and higher quality verse being set by poets. First, with Isabella as patroness, and then following her, others, including Lucrezia Borgia in Ferrara.
Tell me what we're about to listen to and who wrote it.
Wayne, this is Si è debile il filo, written by Bartolomeo Tromboncino, probably for Isabella d'Este.
And tell me once again the title in English.
Yes, the thread that attaches me to you, my lady, is weak.
All right.
This is performed by Anthony Rulli and the Consort of Music again.
Gravo sabbia vita, che solti non la vita, e la fia tosto di suo cor, sua rima. Vero che dopo l'empia di partita, che dal dolce mio pegno, fece sol una spegna, stata infin a qui cagion Dio viva, dicendo perché prima sia della nata vista, mantienti anima trista, che sai sa miglior tempo ancor ritorni, ed a più lieti giorni. O se perduto ben mai sera questa speranza mi sostenne un tempo, or vien mancando e troppo il leva tempo, or vien mancando e troppo il leva.
Bill Prizer, we are listening to 15th century court music composed in Italy. You are a music historian at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and you are looking at, well, not just the musical history, strictly speaking, the social history that's wrapped up with compositions such as the ones that we have heard. Does this translate at all to musical history, musical activity in the 1980s? That's a pretty big order, but let me ask you to speculate on that.
Well, it certainly does in some ways. There is, at the moment, a renaissance of interest in early music performance.
Uh-huh.
London particularly now boasts many groups who do only that kind of performance.
Mm-hmm.
Certain cities in Germany have their own, small cities, have their own resident groups that perform early music. But it also has to do with the discovery that this is delightful music that people have not been able to listen to before. And so we get the recordings and the concerts done by these groups and many, many people attending them.
Bill Prizer, let's conclude. Let me ask you to summarize. How would you characterize the importance of what you are doing as a scholar of music history for modern audiences? Why should anybody listen to this stuff and care about it, aside from the fact that, as you say, it's delightful music. It's fun to listen to. Is that it?
Well, I think that a question could be asked is, why do we listen to any music in that instance? To continue with Mozart, why do we listen to Mozart? I think basically we listen to Mozart because it is delightful music. On the other hand, one can see in all of this music the roots of later music. And to understand what the later music is doing, one has to understand what the earlier music was doing.
Does one necessarily, Bill, have to have a strong sense of Italian history in this instance to appreciate this music?
No more so than you have to have a sense of Viennese history to appreciate Mozart, it seems to me. On the other hand, I do think it's important to try to see these works in their social context. And that is one of the purposes of the book I am writing while I'm here at the center, and books that other people are writing as well. We music historians have been so concerned with the style of the music, with the technical aspects of it, that we haven't really talked enough to our colleagues, that is, to historians, to literary historians, to art historians, and so forth. So what I and others are trying to do here is to build a bridge so that we can write things that are interesting to us, that is, music historians, but also that we'll have important things to say for art historians in their work, for historians of culture in their work, and so forth.
William Prizer is a professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation about music and cultural patronage in the Italian Renaissance. William Prizer recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming book entitled Music in Mantua during the period of Isabella d'Este. For a cassette copy of William Prizer's discussion for Soundings, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, conversations with two other scholars at the National Humanities Center. Zhao Jinglun, a Chinese journalist, will discuss his book about the relevance of the American political system to mainland China's political modernization. And Donald Horowitz of Duke University will discuss his book entitled Ethnic Violence, Conflict, and Democracy. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for a conversation with a music historian from the University of California at Santa Barbara. William Prizer will discuss his forthcoming book about the social function of music at the court of Mantua during the 15th and 16th centuries. How does Italian Renaissance court music reflect cultural circumstances little known to modern audiences? Music at Mantua, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.